From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Well, baby used to stay out all night long. She made me cry. She done me wrong.
That's the Rolling Stones hit It's All Over Now, a song that was written by Bobby Womack, who made the original recording with his group The Valentinos. At first, Womack didn't like the Stones version.
But when I saw that first royalty check, I liked that version.
Right.
Much. I said, good God almighty. I said, man, I could go back and buy Cleveland.
Bobby Womack died 2 weeks ago at age 70. Today, we listen back to our 1999 interview. He was discovered by Sam Cooke, who first recorded him. Womack's other hits include Looking for a Love and the theme from Across 110th Street. Also, David Edelstein reviews Richard Linklater's new film, Boyhood. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Soul singer and songwriter Bobby Womack died June 27th at age 70. Today we listen back to a 1999 interview with him. Womack started singing gospel with his brothers in the mid-1950s. They were discovered by the great soul singer Sam Cooke, who recorded them on his label. After recording several gospel albums, Cooke changed their name to the Valentinos and had them record secular music with Bobby singing lead. The Valentinos had a hit with Bobby Womack's song, It's All Over Now. The song was covered by the Rolling Stones and became their first international hit. Bobby Womack wrote and recorded several other songs that other singers did well with. Janis Joplin recorded Trust in Me. Jay Giles covered Looking for a Love. Womack wrote several songs for Wilson Pickett, including I'm a Midnight Mover. Womack wrote and recorded the title song from the 1972 film Across 110th Street, which was also used in Quentin Tarantino's film Jackie Brown. When I spoke with Bobby Womack, he had just released an album called Back to My Roots. This is a track from it, Sam Cooke's song Stand By Me.
Oh, Father, you've been my friend. Now that I'm in trouble, stand by me to the end, oh Lord. Oh, I need you to stand by me, stand by me. Well, all of my money and my friends are gone. Lord, I'm in a mean world, I'm so all alone, oh Lord. Oh, I need you to stand by me. Tell me that Samson lived in ancient time. I know that you helped him kill 10,000 Philistines. Oh, Lord. Oh, I need you to stand by me. Stand by me.
That's Bobby Womack from his new CD, Back to My Roots, a CD of gospel music. Bobby Womack, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me why you're recording gospel again. I think this is the first time since the very start of your career.
It's because I think most artists and most people in general forget their roots. And if you don't have a root, you don't know where you started. You don't know where you're going. You don't know where you've been. You know, so you'd start all over again. And I found myself getting lost in the shuffle and moving at such a pace being in this so-called showbiz, you know, that you lose your direction and you got to stand for something or you fall for anything. And so I went back to my roots. I always said, I want to go back to when I sung and it was innocent. They used to pay us out of a frying pan. It wasn't about how much money you made, how many hits you had. It didn't matter. People was trying to survive, and we showed them that we was disciples for God. And we traveled all over the world with people like Soul Stirrers. Sam was the Soul Stirrers, Five Blind Boys, which was my favorite, and Swan Silvertones, Caravans, crews like Staple Singers. And we all traveled together. And we were paving the road when Kirk Franklin was getting diapers.
The song that we just heard you sing was written by Sam Cooke, who basically discovered you and your brothers and was the first to record you and give you a big break. Before we talk about that, tell me about the first time you heard him sing in church, and I think this was in the early 1950s.
Yeah, it was in the early 1950s. He had just joined the Soul Stirrers. And it was strange because the guy that was this lead singer of the Soul Stirrers, R.H. Harris, was Sam idolized and worshiped the ground he walked on. And that's who he was trying to sing like. So R.H. Harris started to give him voice lessons and work with him. But R.H. Harris was like Rudolph Valentino. He had a woman in every city. And in every city, he also had kids. So it got to a point for child support, he couldn't perform anywhere because they would pick him up and take him off the stage. So it was really weird. So he says, I can't go out anymore. I don't know why he was able to stay in Chicago. Would it be because he didn't have no kids there? But anyway, he got Sam. Sam was 16, 17. And he said, this guy's got to replace me because I'm hurting the group. And Sam came in and took over. He took over so fast that it seemed like the people forgot about Harris. And Sam came to Cleveland to perform with the Soul Stirrers. And we were trying to get our break. In other words, if we could open up for the Soul Stirrers, at that time it was like opening up for the Rolling Stones. And all of the old guys in the group says, oh, no, let them come back when they grow up. We're professionals. And you guys, y'all nice, that's cute, but this ain't no place for kids. And Sam said, what do you mean no place for kids? And he said, it's going to be a place today. And not only that, I want your mom to find the biggest purse she possibly can, and we ain't singing until y'all take up an offering for them. And I never forgot that.
Yeah, you once said that the first time you saw him perform in church, it's like he's fixing his hair in the middle of the concert. And,
oh, yeah.
And be, women are going crazy.
He would say, wonderful, God is so wonderful. And he would just, I said, look at this guy. Women are going crazy. That was like a rock and roll show. So the older people didn't like it. They say, we don't think that they should play with God like this. I say, look, the Bible said make a joyful noise. You don't have to be under some spell to shout or cry and jump up and dance. I think it's great to see kids dancing off records, whatever. If they're dancing, they're respecting God, and they're showing him their love. So that's what it's all about. So the gospel is the truth. You just have to broaden the scope of it, and they can go as far as you let it go.
Well, Sam Cooke not only let you sing when he performed, he later signed you and your brothers to his recording label and produced you first singing gospel, but then singing rhythm and blues. Now, Sam Cooke, I think, was an inspiration to a lot of gospel singers because he crossed over from gospel to pop and made it really big. So,
and everybody was afraid to do that. Even Sam was afraid to do it.
How'd you feel about making that transition?
I was scared to death because everybody was constantly saying, Sam's not going to have any good luck because he sold himself out to the devil. And he was singing for God. Now he's worshiping the devil.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way we were taught. And I was watching Sam. When is something going to happen to him? You know, and as soon as he had a car wreck, that was a warning. Then if something else happened, they would say, God's punishing him. I said, I don't know that kind of God. Those things just happen. And sorryly, he did leave here with a death you would never expect. But today, I mean, you could be walking down the street and somebody shoot you for snoring or talking to yourself, you know, so it's crazy. But it was then that was like Sam wasn't a violent kind of person, and he died of a bullet, of being shot by a woman.
Your father sang gospel. He sang with a group called Voices of Love. How did he feel when you and your brother started recording Rhythm and Blues?
He was very, very hurt. It broke his spirit. I remember he was so hurt that he told us, he said, all of you guys got to leave this house. You got to get out. You're not going to sing it in here. So he put us out. I quit school when I was about 16. And Harry was 14. He quit. Cecil was 13, and he quit. And my other two brothers had finished. And so we told Sam. He put us out. He said, where are you at? I said, we're standing on the corner. And he says, oh, God, man, I didn't want to cause that kind of problem. But he knew, because his father was a preacher. Mm. He said, I know what you're going through. He said, I just hate this responsibility. He said, do y'all know how to drive? I said, I got temporary license. And my oldest brother got a license. He said, okay, I'm going to send you some money to buy a car. And y'all get on Route 66 and do not get off Route 66 until you get to California.
Is that what you did?
I was supposed to go buy a new Chevy station wagon. But all of the hustlers and the pimps and the fast street people had the big Cadillacs. So I said, I can't buy no Cadillac with this car and go to California, too. So I told my brothers in the city to get a new car. Let's get this old Cadillac. It looks good. So they say, come on, Bob, let's do what he asked us to do. I said, no, let's get this Cadillac. I said, the Cadillac only costs $600. We got $2,700 left, you know. So they said, okay, so we bought this Cadillac, and the first thing I want to do is drive back on the school grounds and talk to my history teacher who always told me I would be nothing. He said, you're not going to be nothing but a janitor. You always talk about y'all going, so we used to go sing, and my father would drop us out the next morning. We come from Florida. He'd drop us out right in front of the school, and we're already an hour late, and we're running trying to get into school. And the kids were laughing, but he would always make a joke. One might go to the board. Who invented a cotton gin or some question like that? I'm looking for some girl. Tell me. Help me, please. Yeah. I'd write it 5,000 times. And he was always, so this guy, his name was Mr. Washington. I said, I got to drive back before I go anywhere. I drove on the school grounds and blew my horn, and everybody came running to the one. It's Walmart. I said, yeah, that's where I got my start. Got me a caddy. You know. So he kept telling the kids, get away from the window. And the strangest thing happened. The car cut off and would not start. And, man, I'm praying to God, Jesus, please let this car start. I just want to get off the school grounds. He said, I'm going to call the police if you don't move the car. And it finally cranked up. And I got it home. We left that night going to, on our way to California. My mother was crying. She was worried. She packed us a big lunch. My father probably was sorry that he had pushed it to that point. But he was a very stubborn man. He wasn't the kind of guy to give in. So he says, he didn't say anything. And we took off driving.
Well, so you finally made it to Hollywood in this really bum car that you spent your money on.
Oh, man, the
car. And hooked up with Sam Cooke. Now, before we hear something that you recorded with your brothers produced by Sam Cooke, I want to just backtrack a second and play something that you recorded with your father, since we were talking about him and his reaction to your crossover.
I hope you play the song I think you're going to play.
Tarnished Rings from 1976.
Yeah,
this is a
song.
Great recording.
Great song. And I heard his voice the other day. It scared me to death because I drive his car right now.
No,
that's
really?
My favorite automobile. It's 1974 Buick, just like it was when he drove it off the floor. And that was the car I purchased for him that he said, if you ever do anything and you ever make it out there, he said, you could buy me a deuce and a quarter. So I said, well, deuce and a quarter? I didn't know what a deuce and a quarter was. I said, yeah, I'll get that for you, Pop. But when I did make my first piece of money, I said, I'm going to get my father that deuce and a quarter. And I asked somebody, what's a deuce and a quarter? They said, he must be from back east. So that's a Buick. I said, is that what he wanted, a Buick, not a Cadillac? No, he wants a Buick. So he had that Buick, and he would never let me trade it in. So when he passed away, I restored the car till its original, just the way it was originally. And I drive it all the time. It feels like when I start it up, he starts up.
Right. When did he pass?
The other day, that song, I forgot I had a CD put in it, and that song just came on. Tarnished Ring scared me to death. I thought my father was in the car. I said, oh, my God.
Well, let's hear Tarnished Rings, recorded in 1976. This is my guest, Bobby Womack, with his father, Friendly Womack Sr.
You know, people always ask me, Mr. Bobby, where did you learn how to sing like that? Well, I think I'll let y'all in on a little something extra. I want you to hear my father sing this particular song. He's
well, I sang a ring that never graced a finger. Time store trinkets made of glass and tin. And how we cling faded dreams that linger. Fancying the past can live again. Tarnished ring and imitation jewelry. Foolish things I cannot leave behind.
All right, Dad, my turn. For this ring and imitation jewelry always bring you back into my mind. When I was young, I thought all...
It's Bobby Womack and his father, Friendly Womack Sr., recorded in 1976. Let's pick up where Sam Cooke had signed you and your brothers, and after recording a few gospel sides, you started to do rhythm and blues. You were, you know, performing, I think, on stage with people like Sam Cooke. I think the Valentinos opened for James Brown, didn't you?
Yeah, we opened for James Brown. We opened for Solomon Burke. We opened for the Falcons, who had Wilson Pickett as their lead singer at that time.
And
Eddie Floyd.
This must have been something different for you than singing in the church.
Well, it was different because the women could come in many dresses and whatever, and... you didn't have a pretty women backstage in church, you know. They caught the service and they went home.
Did you go wild?
I could take them home.
Right.
Then I go wow. They call me Wild Bill Hickok. Yeah, but I tell you, and something like when you first get it, I mean, you basically sing 70% of the audience is women.
Mm-hmm.
But after being in it for 10 years, you adjust and you find out this is gonna be happening every night, you know. you better get used to it.
We're listening back to a 1999 interview with soul singer and songwriter Bobby Womack. He died 2 weeks ago. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my 1999 interview with soul singer and songwriter Bobby Womack. He died 2 weeks ago at the age of 70. I'd like to play what's probably the best-known song from the early part of your career. This is a song you co-wrote. It's called It's All Over Now, which was covered by the Rolling Stones after you recorded it with your brothers.
They just did a commercial on that again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about writing the song. Do you remember writing it?
I remember I had an uncle. His name was Uncle West. That was my father's youngest brother. And he was in love with this woman named Betty Jo. But Betty Jo was going to church with him and Dad all the time. And she was a pretty lady. And one day she just said, enough is enough. And she started going to nightclubs and hanging out. And she used to wear these long dresses. And then she took a dress up to her past her knees. Uncle West could not control it. So every weekend, he didn't know where she was. Nobody knew where she was. They knew she was out having a good time. And she come in, but he'd be talking about, I'm leaving Betty. This is it. No, it's all over now. It's all, I swear it's all over now. Soon as Betty Jo came in the house, was like, well, stick to your guns. Don't. She come in there and she said, how you doing, honey? You gotta get, I got your bags packed. She said, come here a minute. She take him in another room. We never understood what happened. But he go in that room, he never came out. I didn't know if they were dead, but the next morning he'd be unpacking her bags. We said, Uncle West, you fell for it. So I said, next week when she go out this week, don't go in the room when she comes back tight. Hold on to the couch. We'll help you. He kept saying, you don't understand. I said, no, I understand. Just don't go in that room. So the same thing applied again the next week. And she said, come here, Wes. And so he'd be telling me, no, it's all over now. So that's how the song came about. But I used to love her, but it's all over now. And I didn't know about, because I wasn't too young to fall in love. I was 15 when I wrote the song, but just thinking about, that's where the song came from.
Well, let's hear It's All Over Now, recorded by the Valentinos, which is the Womack brothers. My guest, Bobby
call
Womack.
Call us in church. Womack boys.
My guest, Bobby Womack, is singing lead on this 1964 recording. That's Bobby Womack and his brothers, who were known then as the Valentinos, recorded in 1964. So what was your reaction when you found out that the Rolling Stones wanted to record your song?
I was very upset.
Why were you upset?
It's because, as far as I can remember, that every time a black artist came out with a song, you know, segregation was everywhere. It was in music and everything. So they would say, we can't let that record be played on pop stations, which were white stations. So we would get a Pat Boone, somebody to take the same song and sing it, which the white audience never knew it was sung by a black artist. The same with Elvis Presley songs. You know, it was written by a lot of black artists and sung by most black artists. There was hits on the black side of town. On the white side of town, it was a whole different thing. So when Sam came to me and said, Bobby, it's a group called the Rolling Stones. And I said, yeah, that's nice. Hope they keep rolling. He said, no, what I'm trying to tell you, he said, they like your song, and they want to sing your song. They want to record it. I said, man, let them get their own song. I don't want them to sing my song. And he said, you don't understand. They're going to be huge. He said, Bobby, the Rolling Stones coming whether you like it or not. And he said, and plus, I own the publishing. He said, I'm trying to tell you that this is going to be a career move for you. I said, yeah, but Dad, this is our first break.
Did you like their version of it?
Well, I didn't like their version because I didn't think Mick Jagger, until the day I said Mick Jagger can't out-sing me. Yeah. But when I saw that first royalty check, I liked their version.
Right.
Much. I said, good God almighty. I said, man, I could go back and buy Cleveland.
let me ask
so
you about
I've been chasing them for the past 30 years, saying, just do one more song. If y'all do one more song, man, I'll retire to be saying, Bobby, you started us the writing. Because Andrew Odom says, Bobby, when you quit that song, I told him, I said, if you want to be the Beatles, you can't keep taking songs from other people. You got to start writing your own songs. They said, we can't write. He said, yes, you can write. And he was the sixth stone, really.
We'll hear more of my 1999 interview with Bobby Womack in the second half of the show. He died June 27th at the age of 70. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You know, life is funny when you look at it. Everybody wants love, but everybody's afraid of love. You know, I'm a true believer of that. If you get anything out of life, you got to put up with the toils and strife. Now listen, ooh, you're pushing my love a little bit too far. I don't think you know how blessed you are.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. From Viking River Cruises, exploring the world in comfort. Offering European cruises on Viking longships. More at vrc.com/radio. And from eSurance, insurance for the modern world, with online tools that provide customers with 24/7 advice and support. Learn more at eSurance.com. This is NPR.
Trust in me, baby. Give me time.
Coming up, we hear a soul singer and songwriter Bobby Womack talk about his songs Looking for a Love and Across 110th Street as we continue our 1999 interview. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new movie Boyhood, written and directed by Richard Linklater. It follows a family over a 12-year period and was shot over a 12-year period.
It's like a seed, baby. Well, it just needs time to grow. But it's growing. I hope you're knowing that it's growing. I hope it's showing. Yeah, well, it stops. We don't know.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview I recorded with soul singer and songwriter Bobby Womack in 1999. He died June 27th at the age of 70. He started off singing gospel music with his brothers. Sam Cooke discovered them and recorded them on his label. He changed their name to the Valentinos and started recording them doing R&B with Bobby Womack singing lead. Womack's best-known songs include It's All Over Now, which the Rolling Stones covered, Trust in Me, which Janis Joplin recorded, I'm a Midnight Mover, which he wrote for Wilson Pickett, and Across 110th Street, the theme from the 1972 film of the same name. I want to play another song that you and your brothers recorded during the Valentinos era, and this is Looking for a Love. And
Jay Giles Band covered that.
Yeah, they covered that one. Had a big hit. Now you've recorded.
I'm gonna write a song called "Cover Me."
You recorded this twice in your career. Once in the '60s with your brothers, and once in 1974. Solo, and because I'm a swell person, I'm going to ask you to decide which you'd rather hear.
I'd like to hear the version with the Valentinos, because I actually was just copying them. I learned to copy people, too. I was copying my brothers, right. I was covering them.
You're covering your own song.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is Bobby Womack with his brothers as the Valentinos, Looking for a Love.
I'm looking for love.
Now, that session was produced for Sam Cooke's record label. Sam Cooke was shot and killed in 1964, and I know that changed your life in every way. I mean, he was your close friend, your close musical associate. And then you became part of his family in a way.
I married Sam's wife.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, I mean, I think I must have invented the tabloids, because, I mean, they ate me alive. They called me the boy that married Sam Cooke's wife. And I was saying, I got to cut some hit records now, because I want my name back, Bobby Womack. And I figured I don't know if I could take that as through song. You know, it was trying to compare me with Sam, and it wasn't Sam. And I still say today, I'm 55, I was 19 when I married her, that I married her because I saw a move going down where it was separation between the two. Sam played around a lot. People talked and said, don't let her know the business. Don't let her know anything about it. She'll be the first one to divorce you and you'll be broke. Let us keep the money up here. And this kind of thing. And I said, well, and he used to always say, I said, Sam, why don't you get a will? And he said, will? He says, Bob, if I made up a will, my wife would kill me. He said, Oscar, I have to play around. I love women. And that's just my nature. That's just part of me. So he said, but if I should die, he said, bury me deep and put two women on each side of me. And he would always laugh, and I said, I don't find that funny, man. But here's the guy, I mean, I'm 19, and Sam was about 30, you know. And so he thought it's funny. He said, I'll tell you what, you be my will. Something happened to me, you take care of my family. And he would joke like that. But I took him very serious. So soon as that happened, I started being the detective, walking around saying, hey, I know where the money's at, I know what bank it's in, I know this is this, and he also owned this. He owned that? What is the publishing? And I told him the publishing. So you're saying
you didn't feel like you were betraying him in any way?
No, I wasn't betraying him. I was doing just what he would have done if he was here.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I said, I will make sure that she's in a position. I told her, I said, I don't love you. She said, she's the one said, it was like the graduate. She said, marry me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know her like that, but I knew how he felt about his family, regardless of what a man do. You know, I mean, he would have died 1,000 times before he felt that came out, but he couldn't protect himself because he got killed. And I said, it's all over the headlines, and they put it in the worst way.
Now, you were also really well known as a session guitarist in the 60s and 70s. And I want to get to an example of your session work and a very kind of famous wah-wah guitar line that you played for Sly and the Family Stone's recording Family Affair. Where did you learn to play wah-wah guitar?
Well, I just, I play upside down. I'm a left-handed guitar player. My father was a guitar player, and I learned how to play. I taught myself. And I'm going to make it real short. I'm not going to deviate. I'm going to talk a long time. You want to edit me. That's it.
The end.
That's the end. Right. That's a good one. I'm doing it for me.
Now, I know you knew Jimi Hendrix. Did he teach you anything guitar-wise?
No, because we both had two different styles. Even though he was a left-handed guitar player, too. Jimmy was a very gentle guy. very gentle and wanted to help everybody, was easy. I mean, Jimmy would walk around a roach. And normally you see a roach crawl and you just step on him. You know, he was just a nice guy. And Jimmy played different. He could play the way I played, but he also had his style. His style was hard driving. He used to stand up to the... I remember when he used to set his little guitar on fire. He had bought it Sears and Roebuck. And then he would jump on it with a blanket and put it out. By the end of the week, keep doing that to the guitar. It looked like it had been somebody tried to barbecue it. And he said, one day you're going to have me a line of guitars. He said, I get so engrossed by it, and I climax. And I want to climax so much, after the guitar's on fire, I just want to cut it and burn it. And then after I get through burning, break it up, bust it all over the stage and walk off.
Did you think he was crazy doing that to his guitar?
Well, because I've been in show business. I just figured he's just come from another angle.
Right.
I thought he was different. I said, boy, he's weird. I said, I would never put my set no master on my guitar.
Well, let's
but
hear,
now yeah. He had so many guitars, he finally did work it out where he could just burn them every night.
Well, let's hear you on guitar, Wawa guitar, on this recording of Sly and the Family Stone's Family Affair.
Somebody that just loves to learn, and another child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn. Mom loves the both of them, you see it's in the blood. Both kids are good and mom, blood's thicker than the mud. It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
Oh, the bear. Oh, the bear. Still checking each other out, hey. Nobody wants to blow. Nobody wants to be left out. Uh-huh. You can't leave cause your heart is there.
That was Bobby Womack on guitar. Now tell me, you know, Wawa guitar ended up sounding so dated after a while. Like, was there a time when you said, okay, it's over for this style of playing,
the guy,
I'm not going to do it anymore?
The guy that had the name for Wawa guitar, was the guy's name was Wawa, and he played Wawa on everything. I just played Wawa on that song because I was trying to create something, so I said, hey, Sly's never used a Wawa. I'll put the Wawa on it. And we was in the studio, and we were just, like, hanging out, and it came out that way. But I didn't play Wawa on everything. I didn't even like it. I liked it on that song because it just sort of fit with grace notes that he was playing on keyboards.
Well, it certainly adds to how memorable the song is.
But during
is.
Those days, Wawa played on all the Temptation stuff. His name was Wawa Watson, and he was the Wawa king. And I said, one day, they're gonna not need your pedals. They're going to be sick of that. Wawa, 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 wawa. And he used to laugh, and sure, the day came.
We're listening back to a 1999 interview with soul singer and songwriter Bobby Womack. He died June 27th. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my 1999 interview with soul singer and songwriter Bobby Womack. He died 2 weeks ago at the age of 70. Now, I want to move on to another of your many great records. And this is Across 110th Street, which you wrote as the theme for the movie of the same name, which starred Anthony Quinn and Yaphet Kotto. And this was one of, like, the great action films of the early 70s. How much of the movie had you seen before you had to write the theme song for it?
I saw the movie all the way through one time.
Did you like it?
I loved the movie, but I felt that the company really didn't want to let me do the... And I was getting ready to go on tour the very next day. They said, you got to have the score done in 2 weeks. You know, and that's... But I couldn't... But what they didn't know is that that whole story was about something I lived all my life, the ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I could write this song and just keep elaborating on it and do other songs what I'd ever see in the movie again. Because everybody told me, so they should have given you TV... edited version down so you could look at it and you could set the song tones to, you know. I didn't get a chance to do that. And plus, when you're touring and hitting one-nighters every night, I was surprised that I came off with what I did. And I had to record it. All of this in 2 weeks. I went to muscle shows and cut everything and got the tape back, and the guy said, that's incredible. Boy, if we would have given him the time that he needed. No telling what would happen. I said, probably the same thing.
No, I'm not sure it would have gotten better than this.
No, I don't think it would have gotten better because I think you. I'm better when I'm under pressure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's hear your recording of Across 110th Street.
Of a fire, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you're put under pressure. Across 110th Street is a hell of a tester. Across 110th Street, pimps trying to catch a woman that's weak. Across 110th Street, pushers won't let the junkie go free. Across 110th Street, woman trying to catch a trick on the street.
That's Bobby Womack's theme from Across 110th Street. You must have been pleased when Quentin Tarantino used this in Jackie Brown to open the film.
Yeah, because, you know, I used to date Pam Grier.
Oh, wow.
That was Rosie Grier's ex-Rams. That's his niece. And so he introduced me to her after me and Barbara divorced. And he says, hey, man, she's a beautiful girl. And she was saying, I'm going to be a star. And she was real wow, but she was real positive. I mean... She would get anywhere, and anything she wanted to do, Pam Grier found a way. So I've had her singing on Across 110th Street, and that song would bring us both back. And at the end, I snuck in the movie to see it, and I was like just knocked out. There was standing room, but nowhere to sit. I sit on the floor. And so I was listening. At the end, she walked away and got in a car that was the same car I drove when we dated each other 20-something years ago.
You mean the same model car, or the same identical
same
car?
Same model.
Oh, okay.
Same model.
Wow.
Identical to the car. And she drove away with all the money singing Across 110th Street. And I said, isn't that incredible? It was tears in my eyes. And then I started thinking, boy, I sure wish I could be in that car with her. She got all that money. Well, no, we could go. So the only thing, I wasn't in the car.
Well, Bobby Womack, now that we've heard several of the many songs that you've written over the years, I thought we could listen to your cover of a very famous song. And I think I'll surprise our listeners with what it is.
The loveliness of
now sadly gay. The glory that was Rome is now yesterday. I've been terribly alone and forgotten in Manhattan, but I'm going home to my city by the bay. I left my heart in San Francisco.
What inspired you to record I Left My Heart in San Francisco?
Well, I did Fly Me to the Moon, but I did it up-tempo. And when I met Tony Bennett, I was teasing him about it. I said, who wants to fly slow? I said, fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars. I said, but I did fly, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So it was the same thing. It was taking songs way before disco ever came in and giving them what you call a facelift. I took San Francisco. I left my heart in San Francisco and took it up tempo.
And what did Tony Bennett think of your recording? Did he hear it?
He loved it. I ran into him in the theater, and I had been talking all this talking papers, but I didn't know him. So I was trying to ease out the theater for the, and they said that good guy that said your song. And he said, hey, Bobby, come here a minute. And I froze, came back. Hey, oh, man, I didn't see you. He said, I loved the way you did the song. I think it's fantastic. And I felt really good. I said, oh, I'm glad you really like it, Mr. Bennett. And that was it.
Well, I'm really glad that you made this album of gospel songs. And I really want to thank you for joining us. It's really been fun. I really
And Terry,
it.
I must say, you know, next time I'm in Philly, I want you to be my special guest. I really do. I want you to come up and just watch me perform and see. And when I come off the stage, I want you to tell me, Bobby, you're slowing down. Maybe you need to or tell me, Bobby, you're a monster. Bobby, you still got it. Bobby, you're stronger than you've ever been. As I know you'll tell me the truth.
That's right.
I already know. They said, Terry, man, if you're thinking you look good, she say, Womack, you don't look too hot, man. I'm saying, but I mean, I love you, but you don't look good. Take care of yourself, baby.
Oh, you too. Bobby Womack recorded in 1999. He died 2 weeks ago at the age of 70. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Richard Linklater's new movie, Boyhood. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Our film critic David Edelstein has a review of the new film Boyhood. It was written and directed by Richard Linklater, who also made the movies Slacker, Dazed and Confused, School of Rock, The Before Sunrise Trilogy, and Bernie. Boyhood covers a dozen years and was shot over a 12-year period. It stars Patricia Arquette, Ethan Hawke, and newcomer Eller Coltrane as the boy we watch grow up.
Boyhood isn't a documentary, but it has a documentary hook. Richard Linklater filmed actor L.R. Coltrane in intervals over 12 years, beginning when Coltrane's character Mason was six, ending on the far side of puberty. We see the actor go from cute and compact to slightly pudgy to long-waisted and handsome. We're used to time in cinema being relative, easily manipulated, but time actually passing is central to how we experience boyhood. We scan Coltrane's face and body for changes. We come to think of each moment as fleeting, irrecoverable, and so precious. When we meet Mason, his parents have already separated. His father, played by Ethan Hawke, has taken off, and his mother, played by Patricia Arquette, is chafing against the feeling that she was first somebody's daughter and now somebody's mother. Early scenes in the family's Texas home are casual, mundane, but telling details build and resonate. Mason reads the latest Harry Potter and peruses a lingerie catalog and sees a dead bird around the time his mom says they're moving to Houston so her mom can look after them while she goes back to school. As they pack, Mason scrubs his height chart off the wall. I don't know how much Linklater mapped out 12 years ago, but I'd like to think he watched his actors and his own life and let many of the details find him. When the father visits Mason and his older sister, Samantha, played by Linklater's daughter, Lorelei, he's nervous, over-effusive. The subtext of their scene in a car is that they'll grow up and he'll never know them.
Talk to me. Samantha, how was your week?
I don't know, Dad, it was kind of tough. Billy and Ellen broke up, and Ellen's kind of mad at me because she saw me talking to Billy in the cafeteria. And you remember that sculpture I was working on? Well, it was a unicorn, and the horn broke off, so now it's a zebra, okay? But I still think I'm going to get an A, right? Mason, how was your week?
Well, Dad, you know, it was kind of tough. Joe, he's kind of a jerk. Actually, he stole some cigarettes from his mom. He wanted me to smoke them, but I said no because I knew what a hard time you had quitting smoking, Dad. How about that? Is that so hard?
Dad, these questions are kind of hard to answer.
What is so hard to answer about what sculpture are you making?
It's abstract.
Okay, that's good. See, that's, I didn't know that. I didn't know you were even interested in abstract art.
I'm not. They make us do it.
But, Dad, I mean, why is it all on us, though? You know, what about you? How was your week? You know, who do you hang out with? Do you have a girlfriend? What have you been up to?
I see your point. So we should just let it happen more natural, right? That's what you're saying. Okay, that's what we'll do. Starting now.
For a time, it seems the dad wants to reconcile with his wife, but he's a screw-up with no design for living. And then the mom marries one of her professors, and it's on to the scariest chapter of boyhood, since the prof turns out to be a drunk with a mean streak. Along the way, you don't catch L.R. Coltrane acting, only reacting. The changes on the outside reflect some of what's going on inside, but not all. It's not a one-to-one correspondence between physical and emotional. Parents lecture him, teachers lecture him, and Mason grows more inward, out of reach to grown-ups. And then, as a senior in high school, he meets a girl and begins to talk. He's suddenly in a hurry to figure out what part of himself is uniquely him. Linklater has always used time as a character. It's in the titles of his Before trilogy, featuring Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy as characters at different junctures, before sunrise, before sunset, before midnight. They have to reconnect in each film, and fast, because the clock is ticking. I love these films, but they're talky. Linklater is so literal about time, he never seems to use the full, transcendent resources of cinema. He does in Boyhood. You can't call his touch glancing. Each scene is self-contained, but he covers a lot of ground. The wars, the election of Obama, the Texas culture of God and guns, the way CDs become iPods and iPods iPhones. Mason muses about his Facebook generation, stuck, he says, in an in-between state, not experiencing anything. His worldview is evolving before our eyes. I can quibble about small stuff, but the cumulative power of Boyhood is tremendous. Arquette taps into her character's anger and has never been so vivid. Hawk smooths out the dad's hairpin psychological turns by having the character comment on them as if he's narrating his life for his son. Living with Mason, you feel a shared stake. You might think, oh, right, this is how it was when I was young and I felt something new every second and didn't have a name for it. Now I know movies can do something that just last week I didn't. They can make time visible.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. John Sheehan directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Let me go. I don't want to be your hero. I don't want to be a big man. I just want to fight with everyone else. Your masquerade. I don't want to be a part of your parade. Everyone deserves a chance to walk with everyone else while holding down a job to keep my girl around and maybe buy me some new strings and her a night out on the weekend. And we can whisper things, secrets from my
support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from America's Natural Gas. Learn how UPS is reducing emissions in communities with their growing fleet of natural gas vehicles. Thinkaboutit.org. From Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And from Angie's List, connecting consumers directly to its online marketplace of services from member-reviewed local companies. More at angieslist.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, globalization and the decline of American manufacturing. We talk with journalist Beth Macy about how the American furniture industry collapsed in the face of cheaper, subsidized Chinese products, and how one American factory owner fought to keep his business and employees afloat. Her new book is called Factory Man. Join us.